the main thing was just the concern for, you know, him and trying to locate him that night and hopefully get to him that night and what would happen if we didn't.
Coming up, a special half-hour report on last week's Mount Rapinski rescue. But first, a look at the latest basketball scores for the home teams, the Panthers and the Glacier Bears. It's the KHNS Local News. I'm Tara Bicknell. Here's Burn Power.
Here are the latest weekend basketball results. On Friday night, the Haynes Glacier Bears varsity team played at home against Petersburg and lost 47-43. On Saturday, they turned it around to beat Petersburg 44-39. The Glacier Bears girls team played at Petersburg and lost their first game in a last-minute squeaker, 46-43. On Saturday, the Lady Glacier Bears handily defeated the Petersburg girls by a wide margin. At the non-conference Don Hather tournament in Skagway, the Skagway boys lost to Porter Creek, 56-36, but came out on top of Vanier, 53-41. The Skagway girls won over Porter Creek, 46-30, and soundly whipped Vanier, 45-29. Tonight on KHNS News, a special report on Thursday's rescue from Mount Rapinski and the people who helped to make it happen. We hope to present a clear narrative of how things unfolded and to show how the rescue was achieved. Our point is not simply to bask in the adventurous nature of the story, but rather to shine a light on the various people and agencies that came together to perform such a seemingly impossible task. At approximately 2 o'clock Wednesday, January 5th, hiker Keith Hutchins called his father to tell him that he had had a fall on the side of Mount Rapinski, where he had been snowshoeing. His father instructed him to call the Haynes Police Dispatch, where Trooper Josh Bentz sounded the emergency siren to collect the members of the Haynes Volunteer Fire Department and other emergency workers. CJ Jones relates her view of the situation.
Well, of course, everybody runs to the hall because you don't really know from a tone out exactly what's going on. Just the general idea. You know, when somebody's communicating to you with their cell phone, that has made such a difference in the last couple of SARs that we've done because we have direct contact with the person themselves. I think we organized pretty quickly.
Trooper Benz filled the team in on the situation with Keith Hutchins.
Any search and rescue in the state is run by the trooper. They are in charge, and this turned into a major operation, and we ended up calling in people from Skagway and from Juneau. That first afternoon, you know, it takes a little bit of time to get things organized and get people out in the field. I went out with Dave Swift and Chris Miller to look for him from down below.
Jones' team was one of three land-based crews trying to find Hutchins on the snowy mountain in the dark.
It was kind of interesting how things unfolded, though. Greg Palmieri and Roy Josephson started up the Piedad Trail to get up high and see if we could find track. As they were going up before we took off, they started out before we did, the fellow on the ground called in and said that he had seen their headlamps, and so that kind of reoriented us into kind of a different direction. We went up Piedad and then hit the main trail, Rapinski Trail, and then went up to that bench below the south summit and traversed west on that bench. And we did cut the tracks from pretty drifted in, but we could tell that somebody had gone down a gully off to the west side of the south summit, so that kind of told us where he got off up high. And that was late in the evening, and we tried to make contact with him, you know, various places, because we weren't quite sure where we were. We had some ideas, and as it turned out, our ideas weren't really that accurate in our own minds as we were hiking up.
Meanwhile, as part of the third crew, Scott Sundberg was arriving at the fire department.
Well, I received a call at about 3 p.m. The call went out to our office, SEVA office flagged it, and then I was contacted, and they were looking for a ropes team or a technical skills leader, knowing that Keith was in a steep or cliffed area. And so I responded. It took me about an hour. I got to SARS headquarters there at the fire hall, and you know, they had already assembled CJ's team, Team 1. Both of those teams went to the top that afternoon. Kind of were on their way already. I stayed back as a resource. We weren't sure exactly what we were going to need on the mountain and where exactly he was.
As Team 1 and 2 were up on top of Mount Rapinski back in Juneau, the United States Coast Guard had been summoned. Lieutenant Andy Shano, aircraft commander for the Coast Guard Rescue Helicopter 6038 and MH-60T Jayhawk, tells his story.
Myself, Lieutenant Mike Schneider, aviation maintenance technician Nick Giametti, and aviation survival technician Craig Powers, we all came on duty on Wednesday the 5th in the afternoon, and we had only just been on duty a few minutes when the alarm went off, and we all went to our operations center, and we were told about a lost hiker or a hiker who had fallen off of the side of a cliff in the vicinity of Haines.
When they arrived in Haines, the Coast Guard was met by Mountain Rescue Coordinator Sean Gaffney. Lieutenant Shano continues his story.
So Sean came out with a couple other people and briefed us up and let us know that at that time they didn't know exactly where he was off of Rapinski, but that they expected him to be at least at 1,200 feet, if not higher. At that point, we were kind of limited with what we could do because, again, the ceilings were at 500 feet. So a little frustrating because we knew he was up above the cloud line and there wasn't a good, safe way, especially at night, with that snow, blowing snow, for us to get to him.
Jones continues her story.
We couldn't make voice contact with him, and at that point he called in GPS coordinates and was supposed to be like a lot so far lower than us. There was no way we could get to him that night anyway from up above. We just didn't have the gear to go down, and in the dark, it was too dangerous. And so we knew we couldn't get to him from up above, and so we went back down. And by that time, they had sent another team out from down below in another direction and another spot after they got the coordinates. And they made voice contact with him later that night, and they couldn't get to him from below.
But what was it like on Rapinski at night?
I've been up there at night so many times, that wasn't anything new to me, or any of us, really. But the concern was that, you know, he was out and exposed, and we didn't know what his physical condition was or exactly what gear he had with him, and exposure is a major consideration. And we also really weren't quite sure where he was situated in terms of being in the trees or above the trees, or it wasn't real clear. And so up high on the mountain, it was never super cold, and it was windy enough that it was snowing pretty heavily up high, and it was windy enough to blow that dry snow around and fill our tracks in, but it wasn't extremely windy up there at all. Once we got back down into the trees, the snow wasn't coming down as heavily, and there was no wind, and it wasn't very cold, so that was really good. And, you know, we knew if he was down lower, he would be a little bit more protected and everything. But the main thing was just the concern for, you know, him and trying to locate him that night and hopefully get to him that night, and what would happen if we didn't.
Meanwhile, in the air, the Jayhawk helicopter had to contend with a low cloud ceiling.
Helicopters that we have now have a very powerful spotlight. We just got new helicopters this past summer, and it was an upgrade to the spotlight system we have on it. And we turned the spotlight and faced it towards the mountain, and he could see that light. And so what we did was, through the Haines Mountain Rescue coordinating, transferring the call over the radio, we continued to hover taxi until he told us to stop when we were abeam him and directly in front of him. See, we were well below him, so we were at 500 feet, but we had that light is so strong that even through the snow and the clouds, he could see it from his position on the side of the cliff.
Right.
And he was at that point, we didn't realize it, but he was almost 2,000 feet above where we were, because we ended up picking him up around 2,500 feet to 2,600 feet. From 2,000 feet up, that light was so strong, he could see it through the clouds. He stopped us right when we were directly in front of him. That allowed the Haines Mountain Rescue to better pinpoint which side of the face of the cliff off of Rapinski that he was located. So that was good because working with Haines Mountain Rescue, we were able to better pinpoint where he was.
About 7:45 that evening, Aircraft Commander Shano had to make a decision.
At that point, that evening, that was pretty much all we could do. We had limitations with fuel. We ended up getting some fuel from Haines, but we don't usually have very much fuel there that we can get, so we had to go back to Juneau.
Meanwhile, back with Sundberg.
As you know, it took about six hours to at least have a pretty good idea with his GPS location where he was. The GPS was reading that, you know, the Latin long was accurate, but if we put it to the map, it showed him at the bottom of the cliff, and we knew he was on the cliff somewhere.
Coast Guard Lieutenant Andy Shano.
And you know what? There never was a good GPS reading. He had an iPhone, and I believe what we were told was that they were getting triangulations off the cell phone tower.
Scott Sundberg.
So we assembled Team 3, which I led up off of Schnabel's gravel pit and up towards the base of the main face, of the south face of Rapinski, with ropes and two gentlemen, search and rescue from Skagway. They were equipped to spend the night. John and myself were equipped to spend the night. And the main goal was get a physical identification on his location. We hadn't heard from him for about 3 hours via text, his cell phone, or him verbally contacting us, so we were getting concerned. And we wanted to set up operations to see if we could do a rescue from below or basically just get contact with him. So we departed about 10:45 p.m. It wasn't until about 1 that we were in the specific area of the lat long coordinates. So we got up to about 1,600 feet, and that's about the base of that major cliff face.
In the dark, making their way up to the massive cliff face through the talus in the early morning, Sundberg focused on Hutchins' condition.
On a personal level, the approach to the base of the cliff, I spent a lot of time just thinking about Keith and thinking about his predicament. The approach was fairly steep. It had mixed climbing. At the bottom of that cliff is a lot of shed rock or talus rock, so it was at times, even though there was snow underneath the snow, it was broken walking, so it was a difficult approach. When I got there, I just hoped that he stayed where he was at and that he didn't lose a grip or he didn't come down, because it would not have been good. That was really my main thought. And just getting verbal contact with him and trying to reassure him that we were doing everything we could to get him.
It was shortly before 1 a.m. early Thursday morning when Team 3 made contact with Hutchins.
We approximated at that point that he was at least 500 feet above us. And so part of our job was to assess the cliff face and see if we could establish aid climbing or protection to get up the face to access him, to basically stabilize him and perform a rescue. You know, as you know, it was snowing, fresh snow. The cliff face was sloughing, not a lot, but it did a couple times through the night. You know, it was just a very kind of dynamic situation, and we decided that it probably during, you know, dark nighttime hours wasn't the best thing to do, so we decided to wait it out. Once we arrived on the scene at 1,600 feet at approximately 1 a.m., we sounded an air horn, and immediately Keith responded verbally. It excited us, and I'm sure it gave him hope as well. Eventually, we could contact him via our voices as well. We didn't need the air horn. And so we figured that's how we justified, well, he's above 500, could be up to 1,000 feet above us, but since it's straight up, he was receiving the vocal and the noises pretty well. We could hear him. It was faint, but we could decipher a word or two. Hey, I'm here. Stuff like that, that he was calling down to us. And he sounded like he had a little energy.
Communication was about all they could do, so Sundberg and Binger descended again and left Colin Aikman and Ken Graham of Skagway Search and Rescue behind to sporadically blow the air horn.
At that point, we remained in contact with, obviously, IC, and we set up a base camp, set up tent, decided that since we weren't going to perform any rescue from the bottom, we took all the gear that we would need for a top-down rescue in the morning out. John and I took that gear out and we're back at IC headquarters about 4 a.m.
One of the big issues during the rescue operation was the weather. If the 500-foot cloud ceiling stayed low, or if snowy conditions persisted, the helicopter might not be able to get near the injured hiker. The alternative was going to be difficult. CJ explains.
And if that wasn't going to work, we had two teams that were geared up and ready to go up in the field to go up to where we were last the night before and to start going down, rigging up rope systems and stuff to get down to him and raise him up because we knew we couldn't go up from below. So we were going to go down from the top. So that's what we were set up to do. And hopefully if the helicopter couldn't rescue, take care of him, then hopefully the weather would be good enough that the helicopter could ferry the teams up to the 3,000-foot level in the top of the gully so we could start down.
And that would take a lot of rope.
And more than what we have in town, and the Skagway people brought gear, and the Juneau people brought gear, and they brought a lot of rope.
Scott Sundberg.
We were piling gear at IC for, you know, 10, 12 hours, trying to get all the ropes we could get, and then Juneau brought up a coil of, I think, 800 to 1,000 feet.
And if the helicopter couldn't lug all of the gear to the summit?
Plan C was if the helicopter couldn't get the crews up there, then the teams would have to hike up the trail to that point and then start. And in which case, we had a whole bunch of people on standby to help take gear up, too.
Scott Sundberg.
It's a big cliff. It's a big obstacle. And if you kind of weigh it with other things around the United States, if we did perform that rescue, it probably would have been, you know, the largest scale rescue of its type in North America for the season. It's just that size of rescue doesn't happen very often.
Meanwhile, back in Juneau, the Coast Guard rescue team was refueled and flying by 6 a.m.
So basically what happened that morning was it was still in the dark. We had a briefing. We said we're going to wait for a little bit better light and try to get a break in the weather. And the first course of action was for us to try to visually locate him and get a pinpoint location for him. Now, the great thing that the Haynes Mountain Rescue guys did during the night was, on top of sending guys up on top of Rapinski, they also sent crews up to the base of that cliff face, and they were able to establish verbal communication with them, basically yelling at each other.
Right.
And that was huge because I think, one, it gave us even more precise area that it was going to be in, but I'm sure for Keith that was huge.
That morning, clouds had settled in to block the first attempts at locating the hiker.
And again, it's tough because we're sitting there and I can see the cliff in front of us, or I can see where the cliff that should be in front of us, and it's obscured with snow and clouds, and it didn't really look like it was going to break. So I guess it was probably about 9:40 that we decided we had to try to do something. So sometimes flying around here in Southeast Alaska, it's very three-dimensional, and sometimes if you fly to a different spot or around an area, you might find a different approach angle or path that you can use to get to where you're trying to go, especially if you're trying to change elevation.
But Keith Hutchins still had not been spotted yet.
So they thought that he was probably 500 feet above them, from Search Team 3. So we started to search, and we knew he was by a tree, so we just began to basically slowly hover, sliding back and forth up this cliff, looking from tree to tree. He was just wearing black, and maybe in the sense of compared to the snow, it actually worked out okay. So what happened was we searched that area about 500 feet. The visibility was getting worse, and they asked us to move off so they could yell at each other again and maybe get his perspective on where we were. And as we backed off, I just looked up the slope well above us, and a perfect silhouette of a person. You know, good square shoulders and a round head on top, and I said, that's got to be him. And so we were pretty happy with that, and he was well above where we were searching. Again, he ended up being up to close to 2,600 feet.
But could the helicopter effect a safe rescue?
At that point, we slowly hovered up to him. The problem was that we were too heavy. We still had too much gas on board, and we got parallel to him. We assessed the position that he was in. But you know what? We just didn't have a safe margin. We were right at the edge of losing power and drooping our rotor. So we knew we had to do something else before we could try to pick him up. We descended back down to around Haynes, kind of descended down and in between some cloud layers, and then we go through a procedure that's most aircraft can do, where we actually dump fuel. And if you do it, we do it at a high enough altitude that it disperses and atomizes before it hits the ground. So we dumped about 1,000 pounds of fuel so that we could get light enough that we'd have a safe margin.
Even with a lightened aircraft, it was still a daunting task.
The big thing that we saw right then on that first on first locating him was that it was so steep below him and covered with ice, and then even above him, it was still very steep for another 600 feet and into the clouds, cloud layer above him, that we decided that probably the helicopter was going to be the only way to get him off the cliff face that day. To be honest, that wouldn't necessarily be our first choice, because with our rotor wash is so strong, it's over 100 miles per hour. There is a legitimate concern about pushing him off the cliff. And secondly, the other concern is we knew that he'd taken a big tumble. We're always concerned with back injuries in cases like this. And when we have to pick him up in that type of cliff scenario, we don't have the ability to put him in a litter. He has to come up with our rescue swimmer basically harnessed together.
The vertical face of Mount Rapinski at that point presented very real dangers.
That is so steep there. What it made us have to do, we had to do a very high hoist. We had to started out at 150. We were able to do it at about 110 feet over top of them, and we needed that altitude so that the slope would give us enough room for the rotor system to work.
And what exactly was Hutchins' condition? Could he move?
He was in a sitting position. The rescue swimmer Craig Powers, the one who actually went down and hooked him up, described it as he basically had formed a little seat in the snow, and it was maybe 3 feet by 2.5 or 3 feet little square that he had worked out. He really couldn't go anywhere else other than that. And when we saw him, he leaned forward and kind of stood up slightly. So he was kind of leaning forward, and that's how we saw his silhouette. But he couldn't do, from our perspective, it looked like he couldn't do much more than just really sit.
Now comes the time when the Coast Guard lowers the person they call the swimmer down 120 feet to aid the victim, all the while holding on to the cable.
We lower the swimmer directly to the person, and the swimmer takes what we call a quick strop. It's a rescue strop, and he hooks it around the person and then ties the strop into the rescue hook, and they come up together. We basically lowered from about 120 to 110 feet. We lowered Craig down to Keith and basically put him right on the same perch. Craig said that he was in good shape. He was definitely in pain with his back a little bit, but overall he was a real trooper. After spending all night out there, he was very alert and definitely ready to come off. He is hooked into the cable the whole time now, because that was a major concern for us, was creating an avalanche at that time, or also if something happened, if Craig had disconnected, then he's basically in the same boat as the hiker, and he runs the risk of going off the cliff too. So the idea there is that we keep him connected to the helicopter, and it gives him a margin of safety. And also, in a way, he gets used to maneuvering with that extra tension against him, and he can lean a little bit back, and it allows him to be more maneuverable.
And what sort of person would hang out there in the void as the clouds begin to envelop the mountains again? Aircraft Commander Lieutenant Andy Shano describes the swimmer, Craig Powers, and the rest of his team.
He is just one of those guys who comes across as a normal guy, but he does extraordinary things. The swimmers, they also have to be very creative in how they look at problem solving and confident in making decisions, because even though, you know, I'm the aircraft commander and past that, we're making decisions as a crew. Everybody has an input. When he's down there with a survivor, we're basing what we're doing off of his guidance and his commands and what he needs. So he did an excellent job. The other thing I want to say is Nick Giametti, the flight mechanic. He's fairly new to being a flight mechanic. Never ever hoisted anything like that before, and did a super job. One thing that we're not used to having was the blowing snow from the side of the cliff actually took his visibility away of Craig and Keith while they were doing the hoist. So he was going from seeing them and being able to manage that cable. It's very important that he manage that cable correctly for Craig down there. If he gives too much slack, Craig could slide down the hill, or too much, he might pull him away from the survivor. And he did an excellent job. Mike Snyder, actually, the way we worked it, Mike was actually the one in the right seat hovering next to it, so he did a superb job sitting there hovering.
But they weren't done yet. The clouds were starting to come in so thickly that if they had waited 15 minutes, it might have been a very different story.
The weather was starting to close in, so we coordinated with Haines Mountain Rescue to have an ambulance and the doctor there at the airport, and then also we called a second helicopter to see if they might be able to come up, which is eventually what happened. Part of the problem was, though, when we went to hoist him, the weather came down considerably. Hindsight's 20/20, and it's nice to be able to look back and go, that was the right timing, because we wouldn't have been able to get him if we had waited any longer. So, yeah, because those are the decisions that you have to make kind of on the fly. As we climbed back up to him, the snow increased, and basically while we were hoisting him, really all we could see was that cliffside. We really had no visibility in front of us, and I couldn't see the trees below us or the town anymore. So we were in the middle of that snowstorm. It was with pretty poor visibility.
As the Coast Guard helicopter descended, the reaction among the rescue teams below in the Haines Volunteer Fire Department headquarters was jubilant. C.J. Jones describes the scene.
Glad we found him. I'm glad the helicopter could pick him off the mountain. There were a lot of cheers. But when they made visual, and then when they decided that they could actually pick him off, and then when they finally did it, it was like, yes.
Finally, the Coast Guard rescue team landed at the Haines Airport, where the EMT van was waiting, along with Keith's father, local magistrate John Hutchins.
The first person I met when we landed there at the airport, and I walked out, and I was expecting to meet Sean or somebody from the mountain rescue, but they just hadn't made it there yet. It was his father, John, and you know, so I walk up, and you know, it really hits home with you that this is a person who has people that love him, and he's up there right now in a real bad spot. So very very thankful that it turned out well for Keith and his father.
Scott Sundberg.
I think everyone put forth all their 100% effort, and it turned out as best it could. And luckily we have the Coast Guard to come in here and help us out when we need it as well. So
it is an understatement to say that this rescue mission was a team effort. In interviewing the people we did, we are fully aware of how much was left out, especially Keith Hutchins' own story. Some of the people who took part in this rescue were the Alaska State Troopers, especially Trooper John Bentz, who organized the entire operation, Wildlife Trooper Rick Merritt, Sean Gaffney, who coordinated the mountain teams, C.J. Jones, David Swift, Chris Miller, Roy Josephson, Greg Palmieri, Scott Sundberg, and John Binger, who were part of the mountain teams. From Skagway Search and Rescue, Colin Aikman and Ken Graham, members of Juno's Search and Rescue, supplied valuable help as well. And, of course, the Haines Volunteer Fire Department, especially Al Badgley and Scott Bradford, Danny Gauntz at APNT, Chuck Mittman, and the Haines Police Department and EMT workers. The Haines Police Dispatch also played a crucial role in relaying all of the communications. We have undoubtedly left out many of the names of people from the community of Haines who supplied food and many other forms of assistance. In a phone call down to Bartlett Hospital, Keith Hutchins' condition was listed as stable, and he is recovering. And of course, we are sure that the entire community gives its heartfelt thanks to the great service provided by the United States Coast Guard, especially Lieutenant Mike Snyder, Aviation Maintenance Technician Nick Giametti, Aviation Survival Technician Craig Powers, and to Aircraft Commander Lieutenant Andy Shano. One last time, Lieutenant Shano.
You know, I've been in the Coast Guard now for, 7.5 years, and I was in the Army for 7 years before that. So this has got to be one of the top three craziest cases that I've been part of. So, and you know, when any time something like this ends the way it does, it's really rewarding for us. The other thing I can't stress enough also, you know, this was a huge team effort, not just from the Coast Guard. The Haines Mountain Rescue were extremely professional. They had good crews. They got a lot of great help from the other mountain rescue organizations like Skagway and also Juno, and the state police were locked in. And, of course, for us, always got to thank the Alaska National Guard, because a lot of what we do in the northern half of our area, we couldn't do without their help.
For KHNS News, this is Byrne Power. This special report can be heard again on KHNS.org at the News Archive.